I just did. Oh, hi, I'm Louise, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
I want to thank my friend Mark for having me here tonight, and I want to welcome all the newcomers. And even if you didn't stand up, I understand that. When I went to my first meeting, I just thought I was about to barf at any minute, so I could not stand up and identify. But I remember the lady that brought me, she's like, you got to stand up, you got to stand up. And I thought, oh, my God, I've screwed it up already. You know, I'm only here 5 minutes, and I can't even do it. But I've proven that wrong now. But anyways, and I want to thank you for your 10 minutes and stuff, and I really enjoyed talking to you before the meeting. So I will share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like today as a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I grew up in Venice, over by the beach, just like a mile from the beach. Thank you. And it was just me and my mom. She was from Scotland. She was from Glasgow, and she had a really thick Scottish accent. Like when my friends would come over to play, she would stand in the doorway and she'd go, "Right, you come here." And I'm, oh God, here we go, you know. And I'd go over to her and she goes, "What are you bloody saying to them?" And I'm like, "I'm translating, they can't understand you." We were speaking bloody English before you people, bloody Americans. You know, we just went into this whole history, you know, like I'm like six. I don't need a history lesson. Anyway, and so I'd rather be at your house, you know, because the other thing is, like, all, you know, kids are kids and they're going to ask what, you know, they're just normal. But the normal things were not normal in my house because they're asking, like, well, where's your daddy? And it's like, God, if I can't even ask Sadie what's for dinner, I can't ask, like, where's my daddy? You know what I mean? Like, there's a little missing person. But we just don't go there. Like, I knew there were a lot of areas we don't go. So we were too, like, we didn't talk much. We didn't talk about our feelings. But it was very important for certain criteria, you know. It was the 70s. So Sadie, like, we had the shag carpet. It was blue and green. And we had a yellow rake, and that was my wee job to, you know, to rake the carpet. And then we had the glass grapes that were on the coffee table, and those were also blue and green because we have to coordinate. You don't match, you coordinate. And then her parents were Irish, so, you know, in like honor of them, we had the Irish lace curtains all over the place. And windows were always clean. And Sadie came home every night. She was a hard worker. She came home every night. She sat on the edge of the sofa. She watched TV. She knitted. She was a really fast knitter because she learned how to knit when she was four. I was told that later. So I never wanted to learn how to knit, you know. So she smoked cigarettes, drank, and talked on the phone all at the same time. You know, she was just really fast. Like, everything was going. And our house is really neat and tidy. Because then, like, we don't have to look at what the problems are, right? You know, everything's perfect. Like, I had to be, like, on display. Like, it was the 70s, so the hair was parted perfect, straight part, you know, with the pigtails. And it was those, like, fuzzy little bows, you know. And I had to coordinate with my outfit. And, you know, everything was pressed. You know, my socks were ironed even. My bangs were perfectly straight, like everything. And my mom would go, "Look at my wee girl. Isn't she awfully bonny, you know? And you're such a good wee girl, Louise." Until I was like 15 coming home, like days later after drinking, and she'd go, "You're nothing but a bloody wee bitch. She get a Oda head," you know. It's just like all of a sudden it switched. But it just, in Venice, there was a pocket of Irish and Scottish people. And so they all kind of raised all of us and stuff. And every Saturday night, you know, they would have parties and stuff. And my mom, we shared bedrooms. She was always wallpapering and painting. I'm really good at that. I'm an interior designer today because of all this, I think. So she would put on her Engelbert Humperdinck record albums. You know, we had the console with the, it had the TV and the stereo, you know, everything in it, the record album. And of course, the cloth on the speakers had to coordinate with everything else in the house. You know, those things got changed a lot too. And anyway, so she, you know, we had the bedroom with the big 70s flower wallpaper and stuff, and the canopy bed with that white furniture with the gold, you know, on it, and the little fancy handles, you know, from Sears catalog. Some people are relating to this. And the canopy bed with all the chiffon and the girly stuff, and I would sit there, and I'm already impressed, so I can't move much, and she's blonde, and she's got blue, beautiful blue eyes, and she's tall. She's like Doris Day. I think I'm dating myself, like, really badly right now. But anyway, so Engelbert Humperdinck's singing. I'm making her cocktails, you know, these highballs. And then she's putting her hair in a French twist. And there's a moment of silence because she goes over to that, you know, white styrofoam head that has a little hair piece on it, like all the moms in the 70s had. They picked up from the hairdresser, right? And it's just perfect. And then so we have to have a moment of silence because she's got to get it, like, perfectly centered in her head and stuff. And she's, you know, pinning it all up. And then that tall can of Aquanet, you know, and just lacquering the whole thing up. I have a bad cough today, I think, still because of that. I really do. It should be banned. And they still sell it. They still sell it. But anyway, but gee, you have to lock up, you know, spray cans or something. I don't know. It's just weird. Spray paint. But anyway, so she'd do that, and then she had that blue eyeshadow, and, you know, and she'd have her little, like, you know, moms had the little mirrored tray with all their perfume and stuff, and in the middle was the Saturday night one. It was Estee Lauder Youth Dew, and she'd squirt that on, and she'd look at me, and she'd go, right, come on, we're going over to the party. And then we would just kind of, she'd get her bottle and had her name on it. And then she had her record album and had her name on it. And then we would go over, because every Scottish and Irish person at the party would have the same thing, and they'd line them all up. And then Uncle Mike would come. Everybody was your aunt and uncle, my mom would say, because we're all related through the drink. And I got that because they love to party. And so Uncle Mike had a microphone and a speaker, and he had one drum and two sticks, and he was the band. And then so you go, all the kids would say hi to their aunts and uncles. You give them all a hug and a kiss. And I got to tell you, there was one thing I didn't lack, and I didn't lack the knowledge of either, and the feeling. I knew I was very loved. I knew I was adored by Sadie. I knew I was loved and adored by this woman. And I knew all she wanted to do was love her daughter. I mean, I knew she didn't have much, and I could tell. I knew she struggled, but she was very full of pride. And she always stood up tall and a matter of fact, and that she just had nothing but love for her daughter. And I knew that. And all these, and I felt very safe around all these Scottish aunts and uncles. And all the kids that you called your cousins and stuff. Anyway, so, you know, the night would go on. They're having a good time. They're singing and telling stories and stuff. Everybody has the mic, gets the mic once, and you sing your song. My mom was, I'm always chasing rainbows. And my aunt, who was my mom's younger sister, was Stella by Starlight. She always wanted to be a performer. But we called her like a teaspoon drunk, because, like, you know, a few teaspoons and she's gone. And then she starts singing, and her teeth come flying out. And then they're like, oh, my God, Dunny, move. Ina's lost her wallies. And then the dog takes off with them. You know, he's over in a corner chewing on them and stuff. And then she just goes and gets them, you know, and she dunks them in someone's drink to sterilize them. And she put those teeth back on in, and she finishes her song. I mean, this is, like, so normal to these people. Anyway, so they were just, they were a cast of characters. So I, you know, and then it was like we were always looking for something. Like, we're always looking for my mom's teeth or auntie's teeth or, you know, I take really good care of my teeth. I'm a good brusher and flosser ever since then. But, I mean, we may have lost other items, you know, that I was always looking for. Always going back to the bar looking for my shoes or this or that. But anyway, so I remember it was the summer after junior high going into high school. It was that summer. And my best friend Joanne and I, it was that time where there were backyard parties. We found out there was going to be a backyard party, keggers, boys. I mean, I went from Barbies to Boone's Farm to boys, like, in a matter of, like, 4 days. And because I still remember, like, I remember that I loved my Barbies. And I remember the day, like, they weren't doing nothing for me, you know. And I didn't give up those Barbies till well into my, like, 40s. Just kidding. Anyway, whatever. But we all have our own little weird stuff. But Joanne and I, we got on my cruiser, and we went to the liquor store, and we gave a man some money, and he came out, and he handed us two bags. And we went down the alley, and I opened mine up, and it was a bottle of Boone's Farm. I had no idea what that was. And I just cracked it open. I started drinking it. Joanne cracked hers open, and I knew at that point it was doing something different, that it was not doing a thing for her. It made me feel good. One of my old grand sponsors, Marianne King, says, it filled holes that needed to be filling, you know, that needed filled. Like, it just made everything centered and right. Like, I felt fine. I didn't care. I didn't know who my dad was. It didn't matter that I was first-generation American. My mom talked funny. You know, I didn't care about nothing. I just felt good. And so Joanne had the neck down, and she was, like, wasting time because we got to get to the party. So I, like, finished her bottle, and why she jumped on my handlebars, I don't know why, that I should have been on them because we're bouncing into things and stuff. Anyway, made it to the party over on Penmarin Lake, which is really kind of ironic. And we go in there, and there's bands. I grew up at a time where there was, like, you know, all these bands, like Beowulf, Suicidal Tendencies, Venice, Seagull, Eclipse. Like, all these bands are playing in backyard parties and stuff. Or up at the canyons, you go to the beach. You just, someone say there's a party, that generators, they're taking all the equipment up. You jump in back of trucks, and you just go for it, right? Anyway, so we're at this party, and we're standing there, and we got our beer from the kegger. Lone Brow was always great in the kegger and back in those days in Venice. And anyways, and then you look at, and there's these guys, right? There's the one with the blue bandana, long blonde hair, looking real scruffy, and he's looking, and he goes like that. Ladies, if that ain't a panty wetter, I don't know what is. I'm like, see ya, you know, to those girls, see ya, boom, I'm over there, you know. I don't know nothing about this dude, you know, but he this cat filled everything that was like the requirement that somehow alcohol filled in me, that this was what it was all about, you know, excitement. And so I don't know when it was, but he was a drummer in another band called 12 Gauge, and they practiced a lot, but they didn't really have any gigs because they were always messed up, you know? Like, they were practicing in garages. We were down in the underground bathrooms down by the jetty, you know, because they never locked those up, and you had free electricity, and there was another party to be had there. Anyway, so he comes by on his cruiser one night, and Sadie's looking out her Irish lace curtains, and she's like, oh, you're not going over that, are you? And I was, you bet I am. Door. I got to tell you, that was the first time ever after that that I ever got out that front door without her like bracing herself in front of the door. We're running around, I'm going out the back door. You know, it's just like a cat and mouse chase. Anyway, so I jumped on those handlebars, and I'm not thinking like, dude, you're 19. Why do you not have a car? Like, dude, you're 19. What are you doing with a 13-year-old? You know what I mean? And I get on the handlebars, and we go down Lincoln Boulevard to Joe's Liquor. And he goes, you wait out here. And I'm like, okay. And I did. He comes back out, and he has a big brown bag. And he's like, okay, you hold on to that real tight. And I'm like, okay. And I can smell, he had just taken a shower, because I could smell the shampoo and that long blonde hair whipping in the wind, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, oh my God, and I'm holding on to this bag, and I'm thinking, wow, what a lucky girl I am, you know, like, I'm going on a date. I'm going on a date, it's the beginning of summer, I've arrived, you know, I'm not even in high school yet, and look at this. And we're going down Lincoln to Superba to Penmar, and we stops at the park there at Penmar Park on Lincoln and Lake, right across from Clancy's house. And you know, I look in that bag, and there's a 2-liter bottle of Coke and a bag of ice, and then there's this white bottle with this 2 styrofoam cups upside down on the neck. I'm thinking, oh my God, this is so romantic. You know, he's mixing drinks and stuff. And then that white bottle, it says 151. I didn't know what that was. He did. I didn't know what that was. I just thought, oh my God, he spent some money on this date. You know what I mean? I'm just thinking, wow. And so we pull up by the bench, and he parks, you know, and gets out, and he starts mixing drinks, and that was good enough for me, ladies. That was good enough for me. You know, and I found out in a lot of inventory, like just any kind of little attention, as embarrassing it was during that time, but I could tell you today that you know, I just wanted the attention. I wanted to be loved. I wanted to, you know, be needed and stuff. And it just, attention from an older guy, I felt really good. And then I just, you know, went into a lot of blackouts. I didn't know what it was called till I got here. I just thought, ooh, okay, lost track of time. But it's not like something like you're sitting, you know, talking about it. You know what I mean? You're just kind of acting as if. So we tell you when you're new in here, like if you're like, oh, God, I don't feel like doing it, act as if. It's like, girl, you had plenty of help. You know, you had plenty of practice acting as if. I know I did. And so anyways, I would just always go into the blackouts. And it was like, I'm going to date myself again. Like the Dream of Jeannie show, like blink. Oh, okay, here we are, you know, still at the park, you know, blink. Oh, okay, now we're at the beach, you know. And then it's like, this is pretty cool. And then blink. Oh, my God, you're not my boyfriend. And then it's like, okay. You know, it's like another dilemma. But oh my God, you sure are cute, you know. So, remember that song, if you can't be with the one you love, honey, just love the one you're with. I remember, who was it, Stephen Stills, and he goes, I don't know what I was thinking when I wrote that song. I saw him in an interview, and I'm thinking, because you were thinking about all us drunks, you know, like, yeah, because I related to it, I don't know about you guys. But anyway, so it was just always going in and have a blackout. You know, I came out of a blackout. I remember I was at the beach that day with my friend Rhonda, and we stole a bottle of whiskey from her dad's bar. And now I'm home. I come out of the shower. I come out of a blackout, and I'm blonde. I am blonde. And I thought, how'd that happen, you know? And I called her up, and she's like, you don't remember. You remember that Super Sun In or Sun In, and I had Super Sun In. And so you're supposed to, you know, squirt it, and it kind of enhances your natural highlights and stuff. I just poured the whole bottle on my head, she said. And then I'm out there for hours, you know, and stuff. Then it turns orange, like in 3 days. You're like a carrot top. And anyways, it just like always fading in and out of a blackout. And then I remember I remember coming to one morning, and I had been crying, and I had my head was in Sadie's lap, and she's sitting at the kitchen table, and she's drinking her tea, and she just looked really, really hurt. And I thought, oh God, what do I do now? Because sometimes I wouldn't come home, or if I came home, I don't know, remember what I would do, and or I'd come home really late, and it just it was just really confusing. But I kind of felt like if you just leave me alone, I'm just doing, this is just who I am now, you know? I really, like, surrendered to, I just thought that's who I was. And I remember saying to her, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And I don't know where that came to, I started drinking when I was 13, we were just a few months into my drinking, or 8 months into my drinking, or whatever. And she looked at me, and she was so stern, and that pride, and she said, no, we're Scottish, and we drink tea. And alcoholics put alcohol in their coffee. Like, she was so matter-of-fact about that. And I remember thinking, okay, well, I'm out of ideas, you know? And I'll tell you this. For me, as much as my alcoholism and addictions progressed, and I got sicker and sicker, so did my family and the people around me, like my mom. You know, it was so infectious that that's what started happening, you know, of like, we're really not going to talk about it now. And I'll tell you this, the sad part about that, and how I've brought that sickness into our home, was that she had just showed me the bruises all over her body, but I had beat her up the night before. And she was like, not going to talk about it. We weren't going to get help. We're just going to move on from there. And that's like something that if somebody came from where they came from, they don't know, like, she's out of solutions too. What do we do and where do we go, you know, from there back then, you know? And anyway, so I remember when I was about 15, I came home. I had been gone for a few days, you know. I discovered Tijuana and Ensenada. And I would just say I'm spending the weekend at a friend's house, and now I'm down there. And boy, you can forget about all your problems up here. I mean, you come home with a whole other set, let me tell you. But that are worse than what your other ones were. But I just loved going down there. And so I remember coming home, and she just looked at me, and she said, you can't live here anymore. And you've got to leave. And after doing a lot of inventory work and amends and living amends, that I've realized, like, that was a really hard thing for her to do. But she had to do that for her own survival and not care, like, where, like, just kind of, that was her surrender and her just giving me to God. And so I called a lot of people, but this one girl I kind of knew, she said, okay, you can come live with us. So I went up and lived with them. They lived up the hill a little bit. And they had a little boy. They were nice people. They belonged to a different, like every time I'd come to in the morning, go, oh my God, what's wrong with me? They'd have me in the backseat of the car taking me up to, in Hollywood, that big blue church, you know, the Scientology church, you know, and I'm holding two cans, you know, and like this like 10-year-old is asking me all these questions. I'm thinking, how did I come to that? You know, how did I get here? You know what I mean? Like, gosh. Anyway, so I had to take care of their son. He was 7 years old, and I don't like babysitting. I don't like kids. I mean, now I do. I can tell. But back then, it was like, I didn't, you know, you know, he wanted to go to the park all the time. What are we going to do? You know, I just don't like it. And but I had to do it. I do that. I could do the dishes. I'd rather scrub your toilet than, you know, take babysit and stuff. I just can't stand that. But anyway, so I had to babysit the kids. So I got them out every Saturday and that. And then this one Saturday, I was really hungover. You know, you're still drunk from the night before and stuff. And I thought, kid, we got to stay home. So I got some Kool-Aid, you know, because I'm thinking of him. And I had a bottle of Yukon Jack. And so I put a splash. I'm the only child. I don't share much. But I put a splash just to kind of calm him down. And then I finished the bottle, you know, myself and stuff. I thought, okay, we'll sit and watch TV. And then I came to out of a blackout. And the kid's sitting here like this, you know, like, I thought, what now? You know what I mean? We're just watching TV. And then I looked at the TV and I went, oh, my God. We're watching Helter Skelter, you know. Charles Manson. I was like, oh, my God. I thought, I'm thinking, see, I told you I don't like babysitting. Just not good at it. And I'm like, don't tell your mom. Well, I got asked to leave, so I had to move. I just lived with other families and stuff, and I went home for a while. And then my mom and I and my aunt went to Scotland, and we came back, and she was diagnosed with cancer. And she died within 6 months. And I, you know, she'd asked me to stay home. She'd asked me to just sit with her. You know, she'd asked me to just, you know, be a daughter. She asked me to be a daughter. And I didn't know how to be a daughter. I didn't want to be a daughter. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I would just leave her, you know. I wouldn't bathe her. I didn't know how to do laundry. I think maybe one time I made her a smoothie. I mean, I couldn't see further than here. I was so in my disease. And my aunt, her youngest sister, she was a prime example of the way we live in recovery. You know, she was of service to her sister. She was an example to me, although I didn't know at the time until I got to you guys. But, you know, she helped her sister die with laughter. She helped her sister die with a lot of love and grace, you know. When I went to visit my mom in the hospital, I got escorted out the back door, you know, by the head nun, and I was told I could not come back. They will call me when when they know she's going to die, and that's when I can come back, and I would be, you know, more or less chaperoned. My aunt worked at the hospital. My uncle worked there. Everybody knew us, and so it was because I would go in there, and I would torment her. You know, I'd want to know, who's my dad? You know, and I'd get in her face, and she'd ring for the nurse, and it really upset her and stuff, as, you know, that's normal and stuff. And anyway, so I wasn't trusted to be in there with her. And so on July 3rd, 1987, they called me that morning. I remember it was like 7:30 in the morning. I went down there, and I was there. I behaved, and then I just walked out. I just walked out after she had died. My aunt stayed with her. My aunt saw her through everything. My aunt helped me make the arrangements of her cremation. And I remember I just felt like crap, you know, like I would have taken all of this to my grave. I would have never stood in front of anybody and shared this, but I have to for my recovery. And there may be someone out that I can be of service to. I remember the Neptune Society calling me and saying, you know, what do you want to do with, we have our ashes. And I remember saying, just do whatever you do with them. I don't want them. And they sent me a certificate in the mail where they let her ashes out and stuff. And I put them in that drawer where it said, where I found my birth certificate, and where it said father, it says refused to state. And I just felt like piece of crap because it was all about Louise. And And I would just, you know, not go to work. I'd sit in her, I'd wear her clothes. I'd sit in the house and shut all the drapes and wear her clothes. And I'd smell her perfume and listen to Engelbert Humperdinck and just drink and stuff. And anyway, I remember I was in a wedding and I came out of a blackout after a few weeks after, and I was on this date with this guy, and he ended up moving in and we got married. And he was a really nice person. I remember, like, after a year of being married, I thought, oh gosh, you know, we bought a house and stuff, and I thought, okay, you know, maybe now I'm going to be normal, you know, like I'd look at people that seem normal, like you go in the market or you go somewhere and you think, God, that lady seems so normal, you know, like how do I be like that and stuff. And anyway, so we were married for a while. I thought, okay, this is it. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, because I have a disease called alcoholism. You know, I have an obsession in my brain that thinks about it well before I've taken a drink, you know. And then once I've taken that drink, my body is so physically just saturated, needing more and more. You know, I don't have anything that says, oh, I've had enough, you know, and stuff. Like I'd say, Joanne, how come you don't get like me? And she's like, well, I start to feel a little buzzed and I just stop. Maybe you should try that. I'm thinking, oh my God, you're just getting started. Like, I don't get that, you know? Anyway, so I went to my 10-year high school reunion. I came home, and I was in the hallway there and in the corridor, and I don't remember much, but I remember this. I got in the room, and there was a bottle of vodka still there with a little bit left. And instead of drinking it right then or putting it in my bag for later, you know, I went up to it and I poured it down the sink. And I really believe, like, the window, that opportunity was open enough for the breeze of the power and the grace of God to come through and make a change in my life. And I poured it down the sink. And I went home. I don't remember what I told him. He left. And this was the time we didn't have cell phones. And I remember Joanne's sister, Becky, had like a few years. She was like 2 or 3 years in recovery. And when you've got a few years like that, they're really full of enthusiasm and they know everything, right? And I don't remember calling her because I kept going in and out of a blackout. And I had disposable contact lenses at the time. So I kept opening them up thinking I forgot, you know what I'm putting. I've got contacts all over my face. And you know, and I kept looking for the phone book. Anyways, in a blackout, I managed to call her, and she was at my door, you know, and she took me to her house, and we sat down at her kitchen table, and she said, and she seemed to have talked way too much, and because I started to think, like, oh, God, I'm not feeling good, and she said, this got my attention. She said, I have tools to live the way I live my life. I have tools that I can handle situations that used to baffle me. And I thought, oh, my God. I've never heard anybody talk like that. Like, I've been baffled my whole life. And I knew I could trust her because she was the first person that got me stoned. So I knew, like, okay, she's not doing this stuff anymore. Okay. And she took me to the Marina Center that night, and that was August the 8th, 1993. And sitting in the Marina Center, and I didn't stand up. I thought I was going to barf. And then before we got in the car, she was going to take me home. And she said, Louise, they have meetings here Monday through Friday at 6:45 a.m. I'll see you here tomorrow at 6:30. She didn't say if you're up and you feel like it. She said, I will see you here tomorrow at 6:30. And you know what? That next morning, I got up and I showed up. And you know what was even more better about that? She was standing right there waiting for me. She was there. And she said, okay, you need a job. I'm like, I got a job. I got two jobs. I'm working day and night, you know. I got nothing to show for it, but I'm working day and night. And she said, no, you need a job here. You know, you need to have a commitment and keep you coming back. So she started taking me to all these meetings. You know, I was going to Marina Center in the mornings. You know, Tuesday night we go to studio group in Culver City. Thursday night she said, you need to go to a woman's stag. You have to go to a woman's stag. I'm like, okay, you know. And I just figured, you know, everybody was kind of enthusiastic. But the thing was, like, I didn't want you hugging me. I didn't want you touching me. I just, you know, just stay away. But I want to sit in my seat and I want you to tell me how I don't drink today. Like, just tell me, because I especially needed to hear how women were before they got sober. So she said, you need to go to a woman's stag. So I started going to this woman's stag, and these women, they were delightful. We had this old Chola lady, Gloria. She had these long eyelashes that was just kind of clicky-clacked on her glasses, you know, and she always had her nails and her toes done. She wore those muumuus. Her hair was always done. She was very proud to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had her big book, and she wasn't, I mean, sometimes she wasn't wrapped too well. I mean, she had like 32 shock treatments back in the day, you know, and stuff, but I'll tell you, anything about that book, anything about recovery, anything about helping another woman She knew. She was there. I'd call her just in a tizzy, you know, at all hours of the night. And she always got down in the trenches with me. You know, she always gave me a solution. Because I would, like, just pull up the carpet. I'd come home and I would just, oh, I mean, it wasn't even the plan. I would just, like, I had a lot of nervous energy. Like, it's kind of like all that, your anger, all that stuff just got in touch with me, like, all of a sudden. You know, I'm angry. I'm anxious. I can't keep still. I'm washing the windows. I'm cleaning the house. I'm doing this, that. I'm, you know, and I was married at the time. So she's like, no, no, no. So they would come on Saturdays. They'd pick me up. They'd take me out all day just to keep me busy. You know, because even going to a meeting, two meetings a day is still, what are you doing between all that? If it's a weekend and you're not working, you know? I was just a mess. And so she assigned this one woman, Debbie, to me. And Debbie was on the list for a liver transplant. And so Debbie would have to come get me all the time. And then I had to take over the coffee commitment because Debbie had the coffee commitment. And God forbid we don't have coffee and she gets the call for the liver. And then, you know, so Louise, you're taking it. I'm like, oh my God, I don't know how to make coffee. Like, I don't. So I'm at home practicing. You know, another dilemma. I mean, big. I wish I had those dilemmas today. Let me tell you, people. But anyway, so now I'm making the coffee, and I'm calling Debbie. You know, this coffee's making a loud noise. They're going to get mad at me, and I'm just like a wreck. And here's she's waiting for a liver. I mean, she's waiting. You know, on this. So, and she would just laugh, and she would just come over, and she would just help me, and she was so sweet. And we go up to this retreat center, and I remember I'm walking around, and I see this bench, and now I'm on my amends, and I keep saying to Becky started sponsoring me, and I kept saying to her, I don't know how I'm going to do this amends to my mom. You know, she died, there's no grave, there's nothing. You know, there's nothing. And I was so full of shame of what my actions were prior to that. And she said, Louise, you just keep trusting in God and keep moving forward, and the answers are going to come. And so we're at this retreat, and then I walk by this bench, and there's this teeny tiny plaque, it's smaller than this clock, and it said, in loving memory of Herb Anderson. And I remember it got my attention, which nothing really got my attention if it didn't have to do with me. And I thought, wow, that's such a nice thing to do. Like, I wonder, you know, if that's something I can do. So when I got home, I called Becky, and I said, do you think that's something that I could do? And she goes, you know, it sounds really nice, but why don't you call the man that's in charge of the center and ask him if you can meet with him and just let him know you want to dedicate something in memory of your mother, you want to honor her. And if he says it's a tree, don't argue with him. It's a tree. It's not the bench or whatever, you know. You just, whatever they need. And for God's sakes, don't tell them your whole story. Like, not people out there don't want to hear all that. You're going to scare them sometimes, you know. And so I did. I met with this man, and I couldn't get over, like, how sweet he was to me and how he was, like, it was the first time I felt like I was an adult. It was the first time. And I remember saying that to Becky when I went home and called her. I said, I mean, it was just such an honor. And she said, because it was the first time you were acting like one. Like, you're growing up. Welcome. You know, you're growing up. And she's like, so what did he say? I said, well, okay, well, he went on. I mean, I needed a pad of paper. And because it was, he said, yeah, we could do a bench. And then he said, why don't you do some flowers? I'm like, okay. And she says, just say thank you. Thank you. And we walk away. Oh, no, we just built a pergola by the church. You know, why don't you get a table in the guest book, a picture of you and your mom? I'm thinking, oh, my God, this guy wants to be a party planner. He must be bored, you know. But I'm thinking, okay, thank you. And then, you know, your aunt, you said your aunt, you Scottish, you know, she could do some baking and stuff and invite people, I'll officiate. You know, so it was just, the list went on at infinitum. It just was crazy. But I just kept saying, okay. And I knew I'd bring it to Becky and I'd bring it to the women at my women's meeting because we were now, you know, I was a regular there. We were connected. The women, I knew them. They knew me. And Debbie's like, we'll do the invitations on my computer, I'm good at that. And the other one is like, you know, I'll help you do this. Auntie's, you know, I called Auntie and I was telling her about it. And then she's like, oh, we should get a bagpiper. And I thought, oh my God, here we go. This is like out of control. And then I'm like, I got to call you back. And I called Becky and I said, oh my God, Auntie wants a bagpiper, you know, and stuff. And she goes, I think that'd be a fabulous idea. She goes, you know, people have been waiting for your mom to be honored, and especially her little baby sister. You know, she's been waiting for you, and it's been 10 years since your mom's been gone. And so you just let her do whatever she wants and let her participate, because this is not about you, you know? And so she said, you call her back and tell her okay. And also that you'd be honored to pay for it. Click. I was getting hung up a lot by sponsors. And so I did. I called her back. And, you know, my auntie was just so thrilled and stuff. And I started getting to see that love and that connection that I just felt so cold-hearted. You know, like I was just so shut down. And so I just, I remember going to the garden center and my friend Laura's like, you know, what flowers did your mom like? And I'm like, I don't know. And I just broke down sobbing. Like, the only thing I knew about my mom was what I told you guys. Like, I knew nothing about her. And I felt so ashamed of that, you know? And she said, we have nothing to do here. You know, I love you, but we have nothing. It's not about whatever you want in there, you know? Like, we're honoring your mom. And so she had advised me, you know, leave a piece of paper and something to write with, you know, and pray to God. So I started doing that. It was like that 11th step, you know, connecting, like improving my conscious contact with God, like asking him if you could please see fit, you know, for me to know a little bit more about my mom. And as I kept saying that every morning and every night, like I wanted to know more about her. I wanted to. Like I wanted to connect. I wanted to shed that old Louise, you know, that drunken person. And I wanted to be a woman in recovery, you know, and being recovered, you know. And so anyways, I started having these dreams and these memories, not every night and stuff, but then I had my little list, you know, and I went to Laura and she's like, great, now we have something to do, you know, and stuff. And anyways, so we have this, like, this little dedication. Thank you. And then my aunt, like, I'd want to do my amends with my aunt, and she would get just shut down, and I would go to my sponsor and say, what am I doing wrong? You know, I'm doing everything you're telling me to do. I got my little index cards. I'm doing my little... And she doesn't want to talk. And she's like, stop talking. Because I started doing, like, bringing the book. Like, do you want me to drink? Auntie, you want me to drink? I'm going to start drinking if you don't do this amends with me. You know? And she's like, you are going back to these old character defects of, like, you're a bully. Like, you got to stop that. You have to zip it. And it's all by action. So that's how I was directed. And I started doing that with my aunt. And I would just... say, what do you want to do? I made it consistent. Every Saturday we're together. And she would say, let's go up to Mom's garden. And I'd go pick her up and she'd have a bag with, you know, her little gardening tools and stuff and water and a snack and stuff. And then we'd sit down and we'd look out at the ocean. And now we're not looking face to face. And we're looking at the ocean shoulder to shoulder. And what starts happening? You know, Louise, when we were kids, or you know about, and she started talking about my mom. She started talking about their childhood. She started telling me stories. And I am so forever grateful, you know. And I started just having these beautiful dreams. And I'll just close with this. Like, I remember when I was little, we're living in Venice, and our heater did not work. And my mom would put the oven on, and she'd have it open, the door, and she'd have my clothes getting warmed up, you know, when it was winter time, and of course my hair is all perfect. And then she would kneel down on the cold linoleum, and I put my hands on her shoulders, and I look into her beautiful blue eyes. I remember those blue eyes. And she said to me one time, she said, you know, when I was a little girl, I lived in an old country in Scotland, and it was during the war, and I was taken out of school at 14. I was making palms. And I never had a doll until November 7, 1965, the day you were born. And I am forever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for not only bringing a God into my life, for bringing all of you, especially the women that have really helped me, and bringing back those memories. And I was able to love my aunt, and I was able to take care of her up until she died. So anyways, thank you.